Hello and welcome back to the Monday Morning Break. My name is Kando Kutik and my guest today is an English language teacher based in Zaragoza, Spain. I'll be talking with Jim Fuller about his role as a director of studies and he'll be sharing snippets of his workday with us. Hello again, and welcome to the show. It's really great to have you with us as we learn more about a leadership and management role in the EFL sector, EFL, English as a Foreign Language. Now, schools in compulsory education have a principal or head teacher at the lead and subject heads to support the work of the school. These subject heads and head teachers are all supported by other staff and teachers who take on other leading roles or management responsibilities. Outside of compulsory schooling, there are other types of schools, and the one that we'll be looking at today is the private language school. These schools are funded and managed differently, yet are educational establishments where people of all ages become students as they embark on a language learning journey. So, who manages such establishments? How does quality control happen? And who takes care of teacher development and well-being? Well, my guest today is Jim Fuller, who's going to share his journey from teacher to director of studies with us. Let's see. Hello, everyone. We've got a number of listeners. Welcome, welcome to the live show. And Jim will be joining us shortly. Say hello, Jim. Say good morning or happy midday.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Can you hear us? Well, obviously you can hear us.
Yeah, I can hear you.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I'm still terribly jet lagged, but I'm fine. How has your Monday been, Jim?
It's been good. It's been a somewhat productive morning. So, the week is off to a good start.
The week is off to a good start, especially if your Monday has been productive. Well, the first 4 hours of it anyway. Jim, let's begin at the beginning. How did you, first of all, get into English language teaching?
Okay. So it was over a decade ago now. I think I passed the decade threshold last year. So an achievement in and of itself, I think. I was a young Australian living in London, and I wanted to travel the world. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to do that teaching English, not having any idea about what it actually entailed. But then I did my initial free service course and then from there moved to Italy. And that was the start of my language teaching journey.
And your love with all things teaching English.
Yes.
Right? You and I and other people we know belong to that, I think, that rare group of people who, you know, didn't just do it to travel the world, but, you know, started and are still in it.
Yeah.
You mentioned a very interesting thing that you've passed this 10-year threshold. What have you done in those 10 years? What's your career trajectory looked like? So you've done your you did your pre-service.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting question. For me, obviously, I think everyone's journey is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. Especially in some of the work that I've done, I've seen that people have moved into different positions in very different manners. Within my, 10, almost 11 years now, I did my pre-service course and then spent the first few years, those foundation years, right? The early career teacher years, working in Italy. And then I actually found that, I loved teaching and wanted to take it a bit further. And then I started my DOTA, the Cambridge DOTA, which is a high level qualification for language teachers. And that took me a few years to get through that. And then since then, I've taken on various other development courses. I've started an MA. I'm doing my MA through Niall and the University of Chichester in the UK at the moment. I've just got my dissertation left.
Oh, cool.
I'll get around to that hopefully next year. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, that's I've just put 10, 11 years into about 30 seconds. But, yeah, there's a bit of work that's gone into that time, I think.
Okay. And all that bit of work, like what, you know, so that gets me to what I wanted to say. You just didn't, you know, start teaching in Italy, in Spain, and then wham, bam, you know, you've become a director of studies. So you've got not just the teaching experience, but you've developed yourself as a teacher in terms of your teacher knowledge, you know, through other professional development courses. What drives you? What was the motivating factor for you to do that? Because, you know, language schools, they're always looking for English teachers. Let's not beat about the bush here. You know, if you've got certain qualifications, there's always, anywhere in the world, if you have that initial teacher certificate and then one up, the next level up, you'll always find some work somewhere. But you've taken that a step, many steps further. What motivates you?
That's an interesting question. It makes me reflect on those choices. From management specifically, I don't think it was a conscious decision that I wanted to move into management. Mm-hmm. But when I think about the step that I took before that, teacher education, that was a conscious step. So I moved into teacher education because I was fascinated by teacher education as a field of study and of work, and I wanted to work in a context where I was supporting teachers more than just the informal professional development that occurs, you know, between teachers in the staff room. Mm-hmm. And when I did move into a dedicated teacher training position, which was quite challenging in and of itself, you know, that developed over a number of years, and then I changed organizations, and then through that responsibility was kind of linked to more managerial aspects of the organization, and so it developed into a more of a director of studies position than a teacher trainer position. So I don't think there was a moment where I was like, you know what, I want to be a manager. It kind of linked in with my teacher training side that I was doing in academies throughout Spain.
That's quite interesting what you just shared. It reminds me of my time in one of my previous jobs in the UK. We had a restructuring. I'd always been a teacher of English language, either, you know, teaching general English or academic English. I did that here in Germany before my current role. And then I went to the UK and I was teaching mainly on the foundation program where we taught, you know, academic English, academic listening, we taught grammar and things like that. And we'd been restructured, right? And under the old contracts, one could go, at the time I was in a position, my role was lecturer, and under the old contracts, you could go from lecturer to senior lecturer to reader and whatnot. But because we'd been restructured to save the department financially, so to speak, we'd been given different job titles, and we had only one salary scale. So you could go up the scale, and when you reached the top, that was that. So I asked my line manager during one of my annual reviews, I said to him, I said, okay, well, you know, I'm only two grades away from the top of the scale. What happens then? Because there's no, you know, there's no going up to senior lecturer in this new role. And he said to me, well, the only way up is management. And this was 10 years ago. And I thought to myself, no, me, management. Yeah, you see, right? And I thought to myself, I said, no, I really don't want to do that. And the thing is, if you've been teaching so long and you're really in it and you really, really enjoy it, and if somebody comes along and says to you, well, okay, yeah, the only way up the scale is management, you kind of think, how am I supposed to do that, to jump from the classroom to wearing, you know, suits and nice shoes and things like that? So, okay. So exactly like what you said, management is not something that you see of as this is my goal. I don't think many of us in the EFL sector think of that as our ultimate goal. Mm. Yet here you are. So tell us, Jim, what exactly is a director of studies in a language school?
It's that's a very contextually dependent. There's an answer that's quite contextually dependent, I think.
Ah, okay.
So for example, in my context, a director of studies, you could say in all contexts. Let me just go back. I suppose in all contexts, generally, a director of studies is who the person that's in charge of the academic team, and
so
if you're
all
thinking,
the teachers.
Yeah.
Like a head of department or like a principal?
Like a head of department.
Okay.
And in many organizations, especially academies, you may have more than one director of studies, and they may take certain premises and things like that. And if you're thinking about how, if we're looking at the organizational makeup of a language academy or a language teaching organization, a director of studies is really in charge of kind of the tactical decisions. Where if you might compare that with the higher management, you know, you wouldn't say the CEO, but really the big bosses, they're more in charge of strategic thinking. So where is the organization going? What are our objectives? What are the other business opportunities that we can explore? And directors of studies are really the people that are mediating the goals of the organization and the teaching that occurs, and making sure that all of the standards line up and that everyone's on board. So they deal with the kind of the internal tactical stuff, whereas the, you know, above the director of studies, generally they look at more big picture things.
Okay. See, I've got to digest that. A little. That sounds very complex. It sounds very complex and probably, I mean, in my mind, not something that many language teachers can do. So you've got to have certain skills. You've got to be extremely motivated and probably handpicked, right? I mean, you'd have the manager of the school or whoever runs the school would probably see that the candidate has something in them to, you know, be able to make such tactical decisions, to be able to be the bridge between the owners of the school, so to speak, and the clients, the students they serve, the students, the families they serve, right?
Yeah, I think as in many other industries that aren't focused on business specifically, and I'll clarify what I mean by that in a sec. I think a lot of management decisions or staffing decisions are based or predicated on teaching performance.
Right.
So if you're looking in the world of business and management, generally there are courses that people take. There are there's much more of a screening that goes on before people are put into management positions.
Yeah.
Whereas in education, and certainly language education in the private sector, people are often chosen to move into management decisions, based on their teaching performance generally. Okay. And that has its pros, but it also has many cons. Of course, a good teacher can certainly be a good manager, but I think there are many more aspects to management than that occur inside the classroom. There are a lot of skill sets that are not touched on. And it's quite different when you're working with other staff than when you're working with learners.
I was going to say that just because one is a good teacher doesn't necessitate that one would be a good, you know, manager of people and situations. It actually reminds me that, yes, I did have a director of studies role, a position. It was so fleeting. It was really just 3 weeks.
Wow, that is fleeting.
That is fleeting. It's I barely got started and I gave up on it. And this is something I want to ask you about. Firstly, I was young.
Mm.
For me, in my perception, as to a particular age, or a manager needs to be at a particular stage in their lives and in their career. And in relation to that, I felt, in retrospect, I was terribly young. And I had only been teaching for 2 years. I was offered. I wasn't pushed into the role. I was offered because they had a need. I thought also naively that it was going to be something cool, and then it wasn't. So I gave up. I don't know though that whether if offered again now, if it is something I would do, because this may sound strange to you, but I don't like dealing with people. I don't like dealing. Stop it! I don't like dealing with difficult situations. Let's touch on that, right?
Yeah,
teaching performance, and being a manager.
I think you touched on the key point there. I was recently speaking to one of my master's tutors. Martin Clark from Nile, and he was preparing something for a conference, and we were talking about what are some of the biggest sort of things that you've learned since you've moved into management positions. And I think one of my before I moved into the management position, I kind of looked at it as a technical role, looking at being a manager means that you need to learn this skill set so that you're a good manager.
Mm-hmm.
And there certainly is truth in that. There are certainly things that you need to become aware of, whether it's focusing on budgets or whether it's focusing on campaigns, project management, those sorts of things. But the biggest thing that I've learned is to be a successful manager, or at least a half successful manager. It's more to do with how you deal with people and building that safe environment for everyone, mm-hmm. which is not always easy to do, I think. In fact, one of the first places that I worked where I wasn't the director of studies, but it was my first teacher training position. It was quite a hostile work environment for the management team. And a lot of that came from down from the big boss and not having those people skills.
Mm-hmm.
And that was quite eye-opening. And in fact, in that position, I was the director of studies, who I was working under. She mediated a lot of that, and I actually learned a lot from how she did that. She saved the teachers from a lot of the brunt of those lack of people skills, I think. I've digressed a little bit, but yes, I think what you touched on there is that the people skills are what's key. There's a lot of other development that goes into it, but if you're not willing to focus on those people skills, then I think any management position or training position for that matter is going to be quite difficult.
Mm. But I mean, are the teachers, people skills really key? Because, people skills are key in this management roles.
Mm.
Even as a teacher, I need to have good people skills, right? I mean, if I can't deal with people, then I can't deal with my learners, my students. I can't deal with parents. If, I was teaching in a context where I was teaching under 18s, if I didn't have those skills.
Mm.
So I think, though, that while people skills are key, I think what's key also is being aware of what is expected of you in the role. And as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that a director of studies, what they do and what is entailed in the role is very, very context dependent.
Mm. Yes.
Right? And when I look back, at my 3 weeks as a director of studies, see, it's so insignificant. I've never put it on my CV. Maybe I should now. When I look back at it, I had no idea what I had to do. I just thought, oh, right, so teachers, classes, just match them up, make sure the schedule looks good, and that's it. And then there were all these other things that I had to deal with teachers having a clash or teachers not being able to work with certain groups of learners and things like that. And then teachers wanting something, and I had to liaise between them and management. So I think I went into it quite blind.
But I think that's the failings of our sort of sector, especially, but also education. In general, it's quite well documented in the literature that there's a lot of mentoring that goes along with management. And I think that's definitely starting to change now, where there are systems in place so that you have, for example, assistant directors of studies that, you know, that are selected from the staff. And basically what they're doing is they're assisting, but they're also kind of just shadowing at the same time, seeing what occurs and what the director of studies does. So yes, there is a lot to learn, certainly.
And a good way to learn, I mean, you've just mentioned it, is through mentors and what you actually said before, where you had somebody, right? You had someone, you had a role model in your previous role where you were in teacher education, and it was somebody that you could learn from.
Yes.
Right.
Yes,
did definitely. The job with you. So that's important. I think there are lots of management books around that one could read, but I think our sector is, or the private EFL sector is a bit, you know, it has its own quirks. It's unique in the sense that the organization, there's no one size fits all. You couldn't say, you know, what worked for the organization that I was in those many years ago would work today for your organization. And then you have different teachers that you work with, teachers in different stages of their career, right? Then you have those also who are really young, who are just, you know, over for a year or two as part of their work abroad experience. Then and you have to deal with all that.
There's definitely a lot to it. And I think, our sort of the private industry is very unique, which has its pros, but also has many cons. I do think that our sector, in many instances, is not professional. And I do think there are many people and initiatives that are trying to combat that. So, for example, these podcasts and the courses that are being developed, and professional standards that are trying to be pushed in, for example, like people like Cambridge or Equals. You know, there's a lot of things that are happening. But I still think there's a lot of work that needs to be done, especially from a management perspective.
It's really interesting you say that, because the EFL sector, right, teaching English as a foreign language, this whole market, it's been around for longer than you and I have been around. I mean, right, back in the day, you had volunteers from a lot of the English-speaking countries who'd go abroad to teach English as their gap year, right, and I remember a book that I encountered some 20 years ago. It's from SVO. I can't remember what that stands for, but I think it's VSO, Volunteer Services Overseas or something. And it's like, you know, teaching English out of your rucksack or something. And like, you're learning a lot about me today. And then, you know, we've come so far from those days where all you needed to be was, you know, young and blonde and fresh out of school and a native speaker of English, to, you know, qualifications. There was a time when all these, you know, 120-hour initial English language teaching qualifications were enough. And then, you know, we've developed different levels, or not us, but different levels have been developed to kind of, like you say, to kind of professionalize. Or how about give some credibility, you know, if somebody came along and said, you know, I teach TEFL or I'm an English teacher, that people don't just roll their eyes and go, another one of those people. Right. And then from there, you've got, you know, lots and lots of professional development. And then, you know, through, I think, the introduction of academic manager positions in many language schools, there's another step towards professionalizing. I mean, that's taking a leaf out of you know, public schools, right? Government schools, compulsory schooling, that you have principals and head of departments and things like that. So I think we're getting there. We're getting there. It's still a very vague role, I think. And like you say, you know, very, very context dependent. What I want to ask you now is that in your role as Director of Studies, how much of it is managing? How much of it is teaching? How often are you still in the classroom?
Yeah, I was this morning when I was preparing, I was doing like a time audit, which if you've never done, it's quite an interesting thing to do. Basically, you sit down and you look at your week and you kind of just look at the time that you spent on certain activities. Mm-hmm. So I was doing it for the last few weeks and averaged out a few things. And to give a, I'll break down in terms of hours, I think. So from my context, and it's very different. You know, I have friends that are director of studies in different contexts, and they do, you know, a hell of a lot more than me in certain things. Mm-hmm. So I'm generally teaching about 2 to 5 hours a week. And then I have between 2 to 4 hours of meetings. Mm-hmm. And then I have about 20 to 25 hours of admin work. And that might include syllabus development or focusing on the development program, or liaising with teachers, just putting out fires. There's lots of things in there. It's not sort of just an easy ABC. It's a little bit complex in trying to put names on everything, but mm-hmm. that's the general breakdown, I think, in a week, more or less.
2 to 5 hours of teaching. So these 2 to 5 hours, are they classes that you know, cover for teachers who are not there, or are they your own? Do you have your own, you know, set group that you teach, let's say once a week or twice a week or something like that? Or are you just a floater? Yeah.
No, I do. I have this year. I have less. Last year, I had more, and there was a reason that I took on less this year. It was because we. So I have two. So just to clarify, I have two groups that are mine, and then the others I'm kind of filling in. The reason why I reduced my hours this year in the classroom was because of sickness. Mm-hmm. So when teachers are sick. Myself and the director of the academy, we cover classes. And for example, this year we had one teacher leave the academy mm-hmm. midway through the year for personal reasons. And so that meant that we had to cover, you know, 20 to 25 hours of classes, plus cover someone else who was sick. So it's for those reasons that I've reduced the teaching hours, which is good from a managerial perspective, but also I miss being in the classroom. You know, I think not many of us would come into the industry and stay in for such a long time if we didn't enjoy teaching. So that's
exactly,
probably one of the cons of moving into management, I think, is just the reduction in teaching. And mm-hmm. and I don't want to say that teaching is simple, because it's not. It's definitely a complex process. But there's something I enjoyed about the simplicity of moving into the classroom and working with my learners and understanding them and moving through the year. Whereas management is just a little bit of, you know, a crazy, loads of things come at you. Every day is a bit different. Mm-hmm. Some days can be totally boring, where you're just sitting around waiting for something to happen. And then you're working on projects that are coming up in the future. And then something, you know, the next week you have two teachers that are sick, and then you're trying to cover 40 hours of classes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned 20 hours of admin work. That's a lot. That's a lot for curriculum development, syllabus design. What else do you do?
Obviously, that's a mixture of other things. So within that, you might have mentoring sessions or mm-hmm. Meetings with my director. So we look at, you know, upcoming projects. We have our management meetings. Mm-hmm. So I would count those 2 or 4 hours meetings within that 20 hours, yeah. So it is, it sounds like a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I mean that's the time that's dedicated to it.
Yeah.
But we get a lot done. I mean, within our center, we're quite, we do a lot of things that other academies, don't. For example, we run a task supported syllabus, and that means that we're, we're in our first implementation phase of this project. So we're creating tasks, we're using them, we're reflecting on them, and then we're updating them. We're also developing syllabi for summer courses and for next year. So there's a lot of work that goes in to being a director of studies in my context, because I'm the one that generally is in charge of creating the syllabi for upcoming courses and things like that.
Okay, but that sounds really, really exciting. That sounds really exciting. I think that's where also your teaching experience comes into play, right? Because my other question, my follow-up question would have been, does one necessarily have to have an EFL background, a language teaching background, to take on the role of director of studies? If most of it is admin, the way I had it in my stint, where all you had, that's a bit, a bit simplistic said, but if what you're doing is matching up classes with teachers, checking timetables, checking attendance, making sure that teacher records are in order, and liaising with parents and things like that, then my question would have been, then you don't really need the teaching background, do you?
Yeah, I would disagree. Mm-hmm. I do think that teaching experience and understanding what teachers go through in the classroom is extremely important for a manager in our sector. I think within education in general. Mm-hmm. I know that there's a lot to be covered within the world of management and business. But understanding the complexities of the classroom and what teachers go through is vital in making certain management decisions, I think. To give you a very simple decision, simple example would be looking at, as you've mentioned, timetabling.
Yeah.
And understanding why teachers would say that they don't feel comfortable working with certain groups, and then working around that. That understanding there, that ability to empathize with teachers, only comes from, in my opinion anyway, having taught classes yourself and understanding what goes on in those classes. But I think there are a few other reasons why teaching is important. And I've been recently preparing for another podcast that I'm starting soon. I've been reading an article from Masatoshi Sato, who's quite renowned within our field for looking at sort of the research.
Teacher practice. Research. He looks at teacher research, yeah.
Yeah, he looks at lovely things. But he was talking about the idea of this, the research and practice gap. And he was looking at this idea of how people perceive people that give them advice. And often people perceive someone as either having authority or expertise. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about that from the management perspective. And to be an effective manager that touches on professional development as well, because directors of studies, as they're in charge of the academic team, generally they are the ones that are conducting observations, they're engaged in mentoring, they're engaged in providing feedback, sometimes they're engaged in assessing teaching standards. I think there's a need to have both your teachers perceive you as having the authority of the position, but also having the expertise of our profession, so that when you do give that feedback, they feel that feedback is valid and coming from someone with expertise, and so that they are in a position to give.
They respect it more, I would say, right? They respect it more because they know you know about it, yet that you've got that teacher knowledge, that subject knowledge.
Yes, definitely.
Right, and I think it's colloquially, anecdotally, it's what we hear sometimes as well, isn't it? It's, you've never done this before, so you wouldn't know.
Yes.
Right, if it's something coming. It's like the, what you call them, the passenger seat drivers or the people who watch football at home, right? And you go, you should have done this, you should have done that. Well, do you ever play football? I say that all the time, and I never play football. Right? I do many things, but I don't play football. Let's touch on authority. So expertise, people can see expertise. Authority you see in a title. But do you think that your authority is validated if you've gone up the ranks in the one academy, or if you've come into a language school and academy from the outside and immediately taken on the role of director of studies.
It's interesting.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I do. I think authority, and I mean, we know from sort of the field of sort of organizational behavior, authority is a complex kind of phenomenon, if you will, in the sense that you can have your authority that's given to you by the position, right?
Mm-hmm.
So someone says that you are the director of studies, and then you have authority that kind of touches on that respect element there. So we don't need to get into the complexities of that, but I do think that, how can I say this? Teachers that understand the background that you come from, I have found they respect that authority more. And in having said that, like just saying it like that, it makes it sound like as the boss, you're kind of just giving orders and that they're, you know, they're just following your orders. But that's mm-hmm. not the case, I don't think. I think that comes down to what we touched on at the start is dealing with people.
Yeah.
So when we make management decisions, when we have to give negative feedback, when we have to have those difficult conversations, that authority is quite important, but not in the sense of dictator sort of sense. It's more of having, you know, as the position there, they respect your decisions and they're willing to work with you on those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you an example, recently this year we've implemented a policy of not sitting down with laptops. And I recently pulled up a teacher because she'd been sitting down with her laptop whilst in class. But I have a very good relationship with this teacher, and I spoke to her, and she said, "Yeah, that's fine." Now that could have gone one of two different ways. I could have been very authoritarian in that moment and said, "You know, this is the rules, and you shouldn't be doing this." And of course, I've been in situations where managers have taken that route, and it just creates animosity. So those managers, they definitely had the authority of the position, but they mm-hmm. lost respect from that encounter. So I think authorities, it's complex there, but there are definitely different ways of approaching those situations. And I do think it comes back to that, how you build authority within that team context. And a lot of that is, yes, through the position,
mm-hmm.
but it's also in building those social relationships.
Yep. Okay. We're going to play the messages now, Jim. And when we come back, everyone do stay with us. When we come back, I'd like to look at more at the skills, the other skills. We talked about we talked about some management skills. We talked about, you know, having the people skills to fulfill such a role successfully. And I'd like to talk about other skills that management skills is just a whole array of management skills. So I'd like to touch on that a bit more. So stay with us and we'll be back shortly after the messages and this week's news.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR 2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
You are listening to Teachers Talk Radio News, and here is a roundup of some of the main stories over the past 7 days. On the eve of the National Education Unions Conference, which runs in Bournemouth from the 3rd to the 6th of April, it looks increasingly as though a ballot on strike action will be taken. An indicative ballot, in which over half the members of the union participated, showed 9 in 10 in favour of a ballot on strike action. Daniel Kabedi, General Secretary of the Union, indicated that if conference votes in favour of strike action, it will be serving notice to this government and future governments rather than ensuring that strikes did happen. However, he also outlined his belief in the gravity of the current crisis facing education in an interview with Radio 4's Today programme.
There is a mood of desperation, if we're being honest. The profession is very much on its knees. Morale is at an all-time low. And of course, we can see that in the crisis in recruitment and retention. 9% of the teaching profession left the profession last year prior to retirement. The government is continually missing its recruitment targets for new teachers. We missed it by 50% for secondary teachers this year. Quite simply, if we continue on this direction of travel, education will grind to a halt.
Other teachers' unions, including the NASUWT, have indicated they will not be holding a ballot on strike action. However, Patrick Roach, General Secretary of the NASUWT, has called for the replacement of the School Teachers' Pay Review Body, or the Independent Pay Review Body as it is known, with a Teachers' Pay Commission, stating that the current pay review body is not independent, since its remit is set by the government and its members chosen by the government. And this year, the pay review body has been told by the government that it must set a pay level lower than last year and focus on shortage subjects. In other news, this week, Amanda Spielman gave her first interview since leaving as head of Ofsted. On the Difficult Women podcast, she was asked by interviewer Rachel Johnson, while reflecting on her career, about the death of Ruth Perry. Much loved and dedicated head teacher Ruth Perry had committed suicide after an Ofsted inspection, which the coroner had characterised as brutal and insensitive. Spielman said that the inspection had been carried out exactly as it should be. There was nothing wrong with the inspection, but, she noted sadly, it is at times difficult to tell people tough messages. And she compared the Ofsted process with its single word, judgments, as being similar to a driving test, which no one likes to fail. This week, the website TeacherTap, which regularly carries out surveys into teachers' attitudes and opinions, surveyed teachers' reaction to the Dame Sarah Kahn report into threats to public cohesion, in which she'd suggested the possibility of exclusion zones around schools of 150 metres. This came in reaction to groups of parents demonstrating outside schools in reaction to what they perceived as insults to religion among the staff. 58% of teachers surveyed thought this was a good idea. 48%, though, said yes, but the exclusion zones should not exclude teachers' unions or striking teachers. In another Teacher Tap survey this week, the website reported that over 20% of teachers had seen evidence of cheating using artificial intelligence. This was up from 6% last year. Teachers' views were also surveyed in an NASUWT poll that was reported in the Independent newspaper. In a survey of thousands of teachers, 9 out of 10 stated that stress and workload had had an adverse effect on their mental health. And 12% said they used alcohol to cope. In some powerful interviews, other teachers described vomiting before work and having cried at work in reaction to student behaviour and stress. This follows the widely reported news item on the BBC, which said that 1 in 5 teachers in England had been hit by a pupil in the previous year, and teachers reporting that spitting, swearing, and chair-throwing were happening often. This week, the website Education Uncovered, led by the investigative reporter Warwick Mansell, reported the story of Sir Paul Marshall, chair of the ARC Schools Academy Trust. Sir Paul, multi-millionaire hedge fund manager and co-owner of GB News, was reported by the organisation Hope Not Hate, which confronts hate speech in the media, as having retweeted, either casually or thoughtfully, a number of the most extreme Islamophobic and homophobic tweets. Union members at ARC schools have called for him to resign, as no longer fit and proper to be associated with education. And Labour MP Sam Tarry has urged the ARC Trust to sever links with Sir Paul. So far, they are standing by him. And finally, in a widely reported story which appeared in The Guardian and on the BBC and in the Independent newspaper, parents at a Boyne primary school in Aberdeenshire were furious after the photographer, Tempest Photography, issued two sets of photographs of the children. One, where the pupils with additional needs had been removed. Parents received an apology from the local council, which said the decision had not been taken by the school and the link to the photographs had been removed. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news for this week. You can find archived interviews of Daniel Kabidi, the General Secretary of the NEU, in-depth discussion and analysis of the role of Ofsted in many past Teachers Talk Radio programmes, as well as the weekly teacher review on Sunday mornings on YouTube. Thank you for listening.
So, welcome back. You're listening to the Monday Morning Break on Teachers Talk Radio with me, Kandu Kutik, and Jim Fuller, Director of Studies at a language school in Spain. So, Jim, let's dive straight into skills. And my question to you now is, what particular skills or knowledge do you have as a teacher that have served you well as a Director of Studies?
So as a teacher that have served me well as a Director of Studies, there's certainly the awareness factor that we've already touched on, right? So looking at what occurs in the classroom. But I think there are a lot of crossover, especially organizational-wise. Look at this idea of planning a lesson. Whilst you don't plan your week, in a sense, you do, however, plan your day. You take a step back and you say, what do I need to get done? And then you work your way through your list and hope that when you get to the list, there's not too much more to add to it.
Ah, so if I was the kind of teacher who just whinged through my lessons sometimes, that not a skill to have as a Director of Studies. Okay, yep.
I suppose one other... So one of the ones that you would probably add in there is this idea of situational awareness. So when you're monitoring in the classroom, you kind of have an understanding of, depending on your class size, of course, you kind of have an understanding of what your learners are doing, what stage in the activity they're up to, are they having difficulties? And that skill set is definitely very useful for managers, although it's amplified. And sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to get that information that you need, but it's definitely something that comes in handy. And I'm not sure. I think, as I mentioned before, there's a lot of things that teachers do that don't have much to do with management. I was sitting whilst the news was playing, and I was thinking about this. And whilst there are some things that cross over, I was writing down a list of the things that I do. And I was thinking timetabling, conducting observations, providing feedback to teachers. A lot of those things, there are some crossover, especially providing feedback. But the dynamics are quite different, I find. And yeah. I think it goes back to this point at the start. We were talking about, the difference between the classroom and the staff room. The social hierarchy is different. Within the classroom, there is, the teacher, and then there's the learners. And there's a lot of expectations that go in there. And of course, when you're looking at the organizational structure of a language teaching organization, you do have that authority and from top down. But it's quite different. The dynamics are a lot different. There's you're dealing with, you know, especially if you teach a lot of children, you're dealing with adults, some of them at different times in their careers with different needs, with different experiences. And that makes it much more complex, I think.
Yeah. And what you said about dynamics, what comes to mind for me is also, you know, no matter what age your learners, right, as a teacher, no matter what age your learners, whatever you do in your classroom, you do with the objectives and the goals of the learners in mind, right? So if you've got a learner who's consistently not doing what they're supposed to be doing, you know, for example, homework, or they're consistently coming late, then as a teacher, you can say to that learner, you know, look, for your own progress and for you to, you know, be well prepared for XYZ exam or whatever else, I think these are some areas that you need to work on. I've seen that's been challenging for you, you know, coming punctually, for example, right? You can do that, and possibly the learner may or may not, you know, take your advice, but they see it as something that you, from your position of teacher, teaching them, have the right, have the authority to say, and it comes from a good place. Whereas if you've got a similar situation, for example, with the teacher, somebody who doesn't complete their timesheets, who's maybe always late, if you were to address that with a teacher, it comes from a different place. It comes from you looking out for different objectives, right? It's, I mean, the teacher can say, well, I'm only coming here to teach, and my student's always late, so I'll always come in late, and we never do anything in class, so why should I complete my timesheet? But what the teacher there has to do in terms of being punctual, in terms of filling out timesheets, and we've got pedagogical records at this one place that I was at. All those, that documentation, those little bits of work that teachers do, you know, that's not part of standing in front of the class, have to do with meeting the objectives and the goals of the language academy. Don't you think?
I do.
That means that the teacher can't really say, I'm not going to do it. I mean, the student, right? Your learner can say, your client can say, well, no, I can't be punctual because of X, Y, and Z, and no more is to be said about it. But you can't have that from a teacher.
Yeah, I think that's, you touched on something that many managers struggle with. And this is that idea of, it's great to have the good conversations, but you also need to have the bad, sort of the negative conversations. And you know, as a teacher, that's kind of expected of you. But when you move into management, because of the social dynamics, and especially if you've been promoted within the same organization, you have those relationships that have been built up from a sort of a teacher to teacher level of the hierarchy. But when you move from teacher to manager, those dynamics change. And there's often a resistance to not have those negative conversations because of those former relationships. So it's definitely more complex, And if those complexities are not dealt with in an appropriate manner, then the workplace becomes, or the culture of the workplace develops into a really negative environment, I think. And having worked in negative environments like that before, I can definitely see the importance of having a manager or a management team that are very kind of in tune with, you know, what it means to develop a positive team culture or a positive culture for the organization.
Mm-hmm. We talked about, or you touched on, and I opened the can of worms there. We talked about having difficult conversations. Having the good conversations is always easy, right? Hey, that was a good lesson. I observed your lesson. La-di-da-di-da. What advice would you have for someone who had to have one of those not so good conversations with a fellow teacher? How would you, you know, advise them to go into it?
Okay, so any kind of decision, at least from, I'll talk about my experience, right? So I do remember the first few times that I had to have difficult conversations with teachers. And I was sort of petrified moving into it. I knew what I wanted to say, and I knew that I could say it in a very authoritarian way, but I didn't want to say it like that. And so I was worried about how my message would come off. So I remember actually messaging that mentor that I told you about. I messaged him like, how would you go about this with the teacher? So I think it's important that if you do have a mentor, to have someone to share those thoughts with initially. But let's say that you need to make the decision on your own.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important when you're approaching these difficult conversations is to have objective facts.
Right.
And that means documenting things, recording notes. And that's been something that's changed how I operate from my first year of management to now. It's writing down my notes, and so that I'm collecting objective facts on a situation. And then it's focusing on the behavior, but not the person.
That's very difficult, though.
It is, especially when there's been consistent behavior that perhaps indicate that. But what you're trying to address is not the person. You're trying to address the behavior. And if that behavior can change for some reason, then great. And if that behavior doesn't change, then the conversation needs to be had if that person is right for your organization. Which is another difficult conversation to be had. But if we're looking at what effective management is, in my opinion, from those difficult conversations, you're having those difficult conversations because, one, you've set expectations and those expectations haven't been met. Mm-hmm. If you haven't set expectations, then you know where you've gone wrong as a manager. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to put the blame on the teacher. So first of all, let's say that you've set your expectations and expectations have been made clear. We're going to be using that as a framework or as a starting point for the discussion. And you're not just going to go in there with, you know, this, you did this, this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. What you would like to do is go through the event of what happened. So whether they're arriving late or whether they've used the obscene amount of the first language in the classroom, whether they've had an outburst with a student, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And so there needs to be space for them to give their side of things, and then you move through the objective facts. Of course, there are many different ways about that. I suppose the advice that's given often, but it's very, very true, is not to take it personally.
Okay.
Anything that's taken, you know, there's lots of emotions that go in when you're having those difficult conversations, especially if it's coming off as a surprise to that teacher. Mm-hmm. They may react emotionally. So my advice would be not to take it personally, to give that teacher time to digest what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
And then set some time after that conversation to go back to it and continue it if need be. So I think there are a few pieces of advice in there. I'm not sure if I clearly answered your question.
No, you did. I want to pick up on what you said about focus on behavior rather than on person. Oftentimes, the person, the people at the other end, feel that they as a person, they as a teacher, are being attacked or accused. Mm. How can we, in our discourse, if you can answer that really briefly with some advice, how can we, in our discourse, in our interaction, highlight to the person, short of saying, it's not about you, that it is not about them as a person, as a teacher, but rather it's about something that's happened.
I think there are a few things. I've already touched on one, and that's having clear expectations set. Mm-hmm. Many of the organizations that I've worked, everything's kind of been these unwritten rules.
Yeah.
And whilst unwritten rules are good, if we're looking from a management perspective, they're not really that effective. You need them to be clear. And alongside that, and this is the key here, is to make sure that everything, as far as possible, of course, is co-constructed. So that means that when you're setting, so at the start of the year, every year, we sit down with our team and we co-construct our mission statement for the year. We co-construct our vision statement. And then we set the expectations for what each class should have, you know, times that teachers need to be in the classroom. That's all done together.
Mm-hmm.
And so that there is the starting point for everything. And so that's, it makes it very clear that if someone messes up, you know, to for lack of a better word, then it's very clear as to your rationale for jumping on that, because one that's been co-constructed with your teaching team, they're the ones that kind of agreed to it or had some investment in the decision. And so that way it's not pointing out to the person.
But kind like of I like said, classroom rules, isn't it?
Exactly.
Set up with our students sometimes.
Yeah, I think this is, in fact, I wrote an article on it. You know, this is really important when you're looking at observations. Often criteria are made very in a top-down fashion. But really, if they're to be effective, they need to be co-constructed between the top-down and the bottom-up perspectives together. And so that's how you get teachers on board with, you know, what it is the LTO wants.
Okay. That's actually all we've got time for today. But before we go, Jim, one piece of advice, one ultimate piece of advice that anyone had given you before, either your mentor or something that you've learned through your role as director of studies, one piece of advice for anybody who's either currently a director of study or is possibly thinking of going into this role.
Okay. So regarding workload, just remember that the to-do list will never end. It's not about finishing the to-do list. It's about managing it and prioritizing what's on your list. And so once you have your systems in place for that, your day-to-day will be much less stressful, I think.
That would be my piece of advice. I'll take that piece of advice for myself for this week as well. Okay, so everyone, that's all we've got time for, as I said. Thank you for being with us, and thank you, Jim, for your insights.
Thank you.
There are Teachers Talk Radio shows all week, so do listen live or listen back on www.ttradio.org or join us as a host.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.